Chapter 41. Cascada. Matwick, wearing a hat and a cloak, though the summer night held the day's heat, walked carefully in the direction of the Sea Wench Tavern, situated on a crowded, boisterous street near the quay. He hated that he had to handle this purchase himself. However, the wealth in jewels in his purse was just too enormous to trust to anyone else. And if what he was buying was genuine, well, that also was too valuable to trust to anyone else. The sea wench announced itself boldly with the sign of a comely woman in a low dress winking her eye. The open door spilled light onto the pavement, and he pushed into the crowded tavern, smoky with badly trimmed lanterns and pipes. He didn't look unusual next to the regular clientele, and in a dim tavern, wearing a hat, no one would recognise him. He shoved his way to the tavern keeper, ordering a private stall along the back wall, a carafe of their best wine, and a serving of clams. The Lord Regent slid onto the bench. The server was much too busy to take a close look at his customer. He plunked the carafe and bowl down with a graceless thud and sped off. The sea wench's best wine tasted like vinegar, but Matwick sipped from his flagon to give himself something to do while he waited. A few minutes after the appointed time, a man in ordinary seaman's clothing slid across from him. He stood mid-height and was slightly past mid-age, but carried himself straight as a guard. His eyes were grey and his hair flecked with red, with a close-shaven blaze pattern stretching back from each temple, as was typical of Rothers. He poured himself a flagon of wine and helped himself to a clam. Instead of using the knife provided by the tavern, he pulled out his own wicked dagger to open it. Matwick nodded toward the sharp dagger.
"You don't trust me?"
The man smiled, a thin smile.
"Nor you me."
Ah, in this world, how sad it is that man cannot trust his fellow. Matwick declaimed in sarcastic, orotund tones. Then urgently,
"Show me the Rother stone. I'll put it on the table when you show me the payment."
Matwick pulled out his purse and yanked the strings loose enough so the seller caught a glimpse of the jewels within. He left it on the sticky table, but close to his own hand. The Rother reached inside his jacket and pulled out something wrapped in a cloth. He loosened the cloth and lay the stone uncovered beside the jewel pouch, hidden from the rest of the room by the bowl of clams and the wine carafe. Matwick eyed it warily. It looked just like an ordinary stone. About the size of a hand and flat with rounded edges. It had no markings of any sort. It did not look as if it had been chiselled, more as if it had been worn smooth.
"How do I know that this is really it?"
he asked, disappointed.
"How do I know that you're not trying to sell me a river stone?"
"Try it," said the man.
"Place your hand on top of it."
Matwick followed his suggestion. He noticed nothing but the silky smoothness and coolness of the stone. The man leaned over slightly and grabbed Matwick's wrist firmly, making sure his hand stayed in direct contact.
"How many jewels did you bring?"
he asked. Matwick replied, truthfully,
"They are worth 400 golden catamounts." "Do you plan to rob me after the deal?"
"No," Matwick replied. "The truth, again."
"What are you going to use the truth stone for?"
"To find the Princella,"
answered Matwick, and then gasped. For although this was indeed his plan, he had had no intention of telling the seller or anyone this fact. The seller smiled when Matwick gasped. He pressed home his demonstration.
"Why do you want to find her? The main reason?"
Matwick tried to pull his hand away. He sputtered a little, and then he spoke the truth.
To stay in power.
The Rother released Matwick's wrist.
Do you still doubt that I've brought the truth stone of Rotherod?
Matwick shook his head and then used his forefinger to push the purse toward the cellar. The Rother pocketed it.
Aren't you going to count it?
Matwick asked.
No, said the seller.
You and I both know you told the truth, and that I will leave this place unmolested.
He drained down his bitter wine, ate a couple of clams, touched his cap in salute to Matwick, and casually sauntered out of the sea wench. Matwick nodded at Captain Mergen, Jürgen's nephew, sitting unobtrusively across the room. He and his men would dispatch the seller on a dark street. How fortunate the Rother guard had just asked him about stealing back the jewels, not about whether he would live to spend his new fortune. Matwick sipped from his flagon to recover his nerves. Having the truth pried out of him by the stone, regardless of his will, unsettled him. He wrapped the stone back in its coverings, carefully stowed it under his cloak, left coin for the barkeep, then pushed his way back out of the smoky rooms into the damp and slightly salty air. He walked through the cobbled streets of Cascada slowly and hailed a carriage at a busy intersection. Inside the conveyance, he recalled that when Jürgen had come to him with this proposition, he had barely believed him. Once Rotherod had had its own magic. While Wirrendale's powers came from the Nargis River and the Magi of Oromondo controlled Posar's fire, Rotherod's Trinity of Gaia had worked through stones. The Truth Stone, the Protection Stone, and the Repair Stone. Eons ago, when civil war broke the kingdom and the two brothers fought over the marble throne, legend had it that the Protection Stone was thrown off the castle battlements and shattered in two. After this blasphemy, the Repair Stone no longer worked its magic. It no longer healed rocks sundered by quakes. Nothing was publicly recorded about the Truth Stone. Matwick now suspected that it had been held in a treasure chamber unused because the Rothers were afraid to wield it. Afraid of the truths it would reveal. Afraid to confirm it too had lost its powers. Or afraid to reveal to a Naemon that they still had it. Probably the guard had substituted an ordinary lookalike. King Kentros would be wroth indeed if he knew he had lost his last stone.
Fool. Not to better secure such a treasure.
And not to use whatever power lay at his hand. Matwick thought it was a pity that no one would ever know he saved Wirrendale from a similar fate. He let his confederates believe that Envoy Thumb had bargained for the Queen's death, when actually the Oros had angled for a shipload of Nargis water, hoping it would cure their plagues. In the end, Matwick hadn't been able to bring himself to barter a drop of Weir power, not to mention such a sale would not have eliminated Cressa. How unfair that I will never receive the proper honour for my loyalty to my country. Well, now that he had it, and it had proven its ability, he could use this stone to achieve his group's goals. Matwick could place the nursemaid's hand on the stone to see if she knew anything, but he doubted that the servant held vital information. Besides, Matwick recently had received his strongest lead yet as to the Princella's whereabouts. Frisian's labours in the Green Isles had narrowed down the search area to the eastern duchies. But whom should he send out with the stone? Lady Tenny, of course. The rest were bunglers. Jürgen hated clever women, finding them presumptuous. Well, he hated dumb women too, finding them tiresome. But Matwick always respected ability wherever he found it, and Tenny had always been the smartest counsellor. Though Tenny had pulled further and further away from the council over the years, even she would understand that now with Oromondo ascendant and on the march, they simply had to find Cerulea. The girl wandering loose in the world put the realm itself at risk. Tenny would see the danger that if the girl should die without issue, the fountains would fail and Weirendale would lose its magic, becoming, like Rortharod, a lesser power. The Oros might be pleased by such an outcome, but Matwick's first choice would be to enhance, not diminish, power. And he could persuade Tenny that she, above all others, would be the gentlest one to unmask the girl and fetch her safely to Cascada. Sending one of the others would be preposterous. Of course, since Tenny's loyalty remained tenuous, he would have to send escorts he could trust to accompany her. Matwick had the carriage let him off a few streets from the arrival gate. There he identified himself to the palace guard. He took one of their horses to ride down the long avenue in style. It would not do for the Lord Regent to approach the palace like a beggar. He reached his own chambers, which had been still and empty when he left. Now lamps shone out brightly. While he was out, his wife, Tyrannella, had returned from one of her frequent stays at their country estate. He had married her when he was young for her beauty, luscious body, soft lips, sweet disposition, and for the fact that she was the grandniece of a duke. But he had not chosen wisely for his future career. Tyrannella turned out to be annoyingly high-minded. She instinctively shrank away from any taint of court intrigue, and she refused to listen to the gossip of women and report back to him. She found an excuse to leave the room when his counsellors entered. In particular, she found Retzel and Latley unbearably greedy and gauche. She snubbed Prisian's strumpet completely. Matwick rather enjoyed her snootiness, and he still found her attractive. They did not confide in one another, but they were both too proud to engage in either open or covert hostilities. Tyrannella spent a great deal of time in the country, but returned to the palace often enough for her appearances. In return, he treated her with respect and never took a regular mistress, though naturally, he took his pleasure with serving wenches or called for a prostitute when the urge moved him. In fact, he found his wife's slight air of reserve and disapproval a powerful aphrodisiac. He had two major complaints against Tyrannella. The first was that she had not borne him any more children after Marcot, who arrived at the end of their first year of marriage. It was just like her to turn barren and deprive him of more heirs. Matwick held no sentimental regard for babies or children, but he would have liked to surround himself with dutiful offspring. The second arose from how she had raised the one son she had deigned to provide him. Oh, she had been an attentive mother, and Marcot had been well instructed. Matwick trusted she had never actually complained to Marcot about his father, but the boy had imbibed from her an air of distance and judgment. And Matwick wanted more from his son. Loyalty, respect, mayhap even affection. Every time the boy gazed fondly at his mother, Matwick had to fight down bitterness. Marcot and Tyrannella both sat in his sitting room. They rose to greet him.
"Lady wife," said Matwick, kissing her cheek. "How lovely you look in that gown."
She wore the amber earbobs he had sent as a gift. He gave one a tiny tap to show he noticed.
"Marcot, my son, how fare you?"
"Quite well, father," he replied.
At 19 summers, he had reached his full height. The country life had given him good colour and a manly physique, though Matwick always regretted that he shared his mother's soft doe eyes.
"You have been out late tonight, Lord Husband. Have you dined? Marcot and I have just completed our meal. Shall I order for you?"
offered Tyrannella.
"Pray do so.
While Matwick gave his cloak and hat to his valet, he overheard his wife ordering dishes with meticulous instructions about how rare he liked his meat. Of course, the kitchens knew these details by now, but this was one way she publicly demonstrated her loyalty. His little family joined him at the table. Marcot even ate again lightly while Tyrannella toyed with the spoons. Matwick inquired about their interests, such as her patronage of a local underschool and the boys riding and hunting. Marcot politely thanked him for the new saddle he had sent. Matwick felt moved by the events of this strange evening to speak up about a decision he'd made long ago but had delayed voicing.
Marcot,
Matwick said,
"'tis time you relocated permanently into the palace. You need to learn the details of administration. You've grown to manhood now and can no longer put off taking up the duties of maturity."
Tyrannella started. Matwick took her hand and kissed her palm, adding just the briefest lick of his tongue.
"I am not taking him away from you, my dear. With Marcot here, possibly I will see you more often." "Well, Marcot," he pressed.
"As you wish, father," he replied. "I will do my best."
This was not the answer Matwick had hoped for. He felt the truth stone as a hard lump against his waist. He longed to pull it out and ask his son, "Do you love me? How can I make you love me?" But of course, Matwick did not do so. He feared the answers. Perhaps this was why King Kentros had never used the stone.